This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership, a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them, too, I must have this thing. I was talking to Tim the other day, and I told him that I knew Cece, and I'd heard her story before, and then I came in, and he introduced me to Cece, and I realized it's a different Cece. I don't know Cece very well, but we're getting ready to find out all about her, so everybody give a hand to Cece.
Hi, my name is Cece. I am an alcoholic. Good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is July 8, 1985. I've only had one sobriety date. That's because I hit, and I hit hard. My face scraped concrete. With every fiber of my being, I did not want to be an alcoholic. That's what I need you to know. My home group is the Clarkston 12-step group in Tucker. Got some of my peeps here tonight. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, all we ever do is share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And whenever I'm asked to speak, that's what I do to the best of my ability. You might hear a little bit of a twang, and that's because I'm from Kansas. I always start the same way, and right now I'll just bust Chris's father, Tom, because he asked me where I was from. I said I was from Kansas, and he immediately went to Dorothy. So if you've got any jokes about Kansas, I'm going to tell you now, I don't have a dog named Toto. I don't have an Auntie M. But what I can tell you is I do believe that there's no place like home. And this is home. I am at home in my body. I am at home in my body. And when I got here, I wanted to be anybody other than Cece Garrison. I will let you know in no uncertain terms that when I talk, it is interactive. What that means is I'm not doing this by myself. So if I ask you a question, I really expect you to answer me. And I speak all around the country, so I always have everybody show me what you got. So if I ask you, do you hear me?
Yes.
Now see, that was pathetic. So we're going to do it again. If I ask you, do you hear me?
Yes.
See, that's what I'm talking about. That's called interactive, a little bit of call and response. Started drinking, boys, 17 years of age. Small town, Kansas. No experience. Mama bootlegged whiskey to get the money to put herself through nursing school. When I was growing up, something was different about me. And I knew it early on. I keep saying I should have grown up to be a private detective because there was something different about me. I was third out of six kids, and what I figured out at age 11 was that I had a different father. And my father was the drunk who lived down the street. And I swore at age 11 that I would never, ever, ever be a drunk like them. That's until I took the first drink with that boy in his daddy's car on top of a hotel in Kansas City that was fashioned after Seville, Spain. He brought me a red rose for love, a white rose for peace, and a bottle of New York State Taylor pink champagne with the champagne glasses. And I don't know about you, but I like the accoutrements. I like all of the stuff that goes with it, the nice flutes. I like all of that. I left home at 17, right after high school, with that boy. I'm going to date myself now. We were headed for the Woodstock Pop Festival. All the hippies in the group know that. But we came up $60 short, so instead we ended up going west to the Colorado Rocky Mountains. Now let me tell you, coming from a small town in Kansas, had never seen the ocean, never seen the mountains, nothing. We got to Colorado, and what I can share with you is those purple mountains' majesty, it was glorious. The height of that vacation was a tour of the Coors Brewery in Golden, Colorado. They had all the accoutrements. They gave you a commemorative glass once you got through. I didn't like the smell of the hops or the barley, but you know what? I like the accoutrements. That was the summer of 1969. I had myself declared an emancipated minor, and I entered the University of Kansas at Lawrence in the fall, and he entered the University of Missouri at Kansas City. And he couldn't find me that whole fall, so he came up, put an engagement ring on my finger, and what ended up happening is that we ended up going to Boulder, Colorado. We made runs to Boulder, Colorado to pick up product to come back and sell it on the campus in Lawrence. I call that performing a community service. However, the police kicked in his door at 4 a.m. one morning with a grand jury indictment and put him in jail. And being the loyal kind of person that I am, I moved to California. I was packed and moved within 3 days. You know, quiet as is kept, I wanted to be a movie star. That was my dream. I'm going to be a movie star. You know, I'm smart enough for Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune, but, you know, I'm going to go to California and I'm going to be a movie star. So I got to California. I was 20 years old. I turned 21 out there. I walked into an employment, the personnel manager's office at a bank in San Rafael, California, and I got a job. I said, I want a job for my 21st birthday, and he gave it to me. And so by day, I was a mild-mannered bank teller in Sausalito, California, wearing bank uniforms. But at night, I took off that bank uniform. I put on something lush and exotic, and I went downtown Sausalito to the Fern Bars. You old hippies know what I'm talking about. The kind with the hanging plants, with the exotic drinks, with the little umbrellas in them. You know, I mean, let me tell you, coming from Kansas, I didn't grow up with the nightlife, okay? I was a nerd, well, a nerdette. I was a bookworm. You could cheat off of me and pass. I didn't know how to dance. I didn't dance in high school. You know, kids being cruel the way they were, they told me I danced like a white girl. So it's like, so here I am in California. Nobody knows me. So under the influence, I let those Kansas inhibitions go, and I went down to the bars, the Boathouse, Zach's, and I danced. I got down. Because quiet as it's kept, I love the nightlife. I love to boogie. You know that song. I know you know the song. Anyway, I started doing theater in San Francisco. I joined a small theater company in San Francisco, and the bridge toll was 50 cents to cross from Marin to San Francisco. And when the bridge toll went up to 75 cents, I boycotted San Francisco and started doing theater in Marin. And somebody said, Cece, if you're serious, you need to go to the Mecca. You need to go to Los Angeles. So I quit the job at the bank. I packed up everything I owned in my 68 Mustang. And without any prospect of employment, I drove to Southern California. because I'm going to be somebody. I call that now the folly of youth. But I was stupid. I was young, and it's like, if you're going to go to the Mecca, go. So I got there. I spent the first 3 weeks in Tarzana. I walked into an employment agency in Reseda, and I walked out of that employment agency with a job for a huge name entertainer who always remains anonymous. And you know what? I got a 2-bedroom apartment in Beverly Hills, California, and no, my zip code was not 90210. It was 90212, but you know what? In Kansas, they didn't know any different. I would call home on the weekend. My mama would say, "Are you working?" I would say, "Yes." Then after that, what I did was nobody's business but my own. And I was off to the races. I was 18 plus 3 plus with a bullet, don't you know? I did everything that I wanted to do. I need you to hear that. I did everything that I wanted to do. I was saying, "You're not the boss of me," long before I got here. When I hit hard. But see, I didn't see me cross the line because I was having fun. I didn't see me cross the line. I was living for the weekend, and then it turned into Wednesday, and then Tuesday was ladies' night. I didn't see me getting jump-started on Monday. I didn't see me cross the line from heavy drinking into alcoholism. Because understand something, I said, I'm not going to be a drunk like him. I got a call in the fall of 1969 from my mother. I ran down 7 flights of stairs to get the call, and she was calling to tell me that my biological father had been shot to death by his wife, drinking. I said, "Why are you telling me this? You said he never did anything for me. Why are you telling me this?" That's what he gets for being a drunk. And let me tell you, I felt nothing. Do you hear me? I felt nothing. I did not see me cross the line. I believe I have a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. I didn't see me cross the line. And because I believe in singleness of purpose, I'm going to stick with my alcoholism, but I took mood-enhancing, mind-altering substances that accelerated my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to let you know that. So I ended up writing in my journal when I first went south to Los Angeles, because I was dating somebody who was climbing a corporate ladder. I said, if he's smart, he won't let me stay down here too long, if he's smart. In 1974, 1976, I was in Beverly Hills. In the fall of 1976, he came and got me, and I went back up to Northern California, and I got married, because all my books of higher learning says that a woman of 25 should be married. My books of higher learning were Cosmopolitan Magazine, Brides Magazine, Vogue Magazine. They all said I should be married. So I got married. I became a corporate wife, and that was in October of 1976. In March of 1977, we embarked on a trip to Europe. I married a European. I had to learn another language, chameleon. So I learned to speak German, and we went to, that's God calling. And we went to Munich, Germany. We got there March 16th. April 1st, his mama left her husband, her 5th husband, because she wanted to live with her son. And so we went to Vienna, and we got his mama and brought her back to Munich to live with us in our hotel apartment. I didn't like that. No, I'm supposed to be a bride for the whole first year. So I ended up going to the hotel bar, the Sheraton across the street, While he went to work, I left his mama in the apartment. And over dark beer, I taught them English and they taught me German. And then I got a ticket back to America. Give me a ticket home. And I came back to America and I went back to the place where I was somebody. I went back to the bars. I went back to the bar where I didn't have to stand in line because they knew me at the door. Where I didn't have to wait for a table because the waitresses knew me. Where the DJ spun the records that I wanted to hear because I was having an affair with him. I went back to where I was somebody. I went back into the bars. I did not see me cross the line. Quiet as it's kept, you know what? The marriage did not last. I got divorced in June of 1978. It didn't last. And I was on my own. On my own, don't tell me what to do. Don't even look like you want to tell me what to do, and your mama. The beginning of the end came for me starting in 1984. I got a call that I wasn't prepared for. June 18th, 1984, my mother died. Now, my mother died, my father died, my real father died, and they didn't tell me what to do. I'm a skeleton in the closet. They hadn't told me what to do. What I can share with you is I was raised to take care of business all my life. I've been a businesswoman since I was seven. So I got my younger brother out of Sacramento, got on a plane, started going to Kansas so I could take care of business and bury Mama. My younger brother did the most natural thing in the world. He just started wailing. And I started explaining it to the flight attendant. We just lost our mother. So she gave us free drinks. I got to Kansas and I could only stay at the homestead for 3 days because I got to take care of business. What I can share with you is that even on the day of the funeral, I could not do it without taking something. I went into the bathroom. I said, I'm sorry, God, I'm sorry, Mama, but I got to take care of business, and I got loaded. After 3 days, I moved into a hotel, into a motel. The only time I would allow myself to feel anything was when I was in the shower. I would turn on the water, it would hit my face, I would start to cry, and then I would immediately say, dry up, you got to take care of business. I stayed in Kansas a total of 10 days, and then I went back to California. And when all else fails, just work. Doesn't matter how you feel, put your head to the grindstone and just work. And that's what I did. People at my job said, Cece, you've experienced a terrible loss. You need to feel, you need to grieve. But see, they didn't understand that if I ever allowed myself to start feeling, I would never stop. Finally, in October of 1984, I went to see a counselor. And I don't know what possessed me this one day, but I looked at John and I said, if I never say it again, I think I might have a problem with alcohol and drugs. And he looked at me and he said, would you like some help? And I said, yes. And then he never brought it up again. I never brought it up again. We just acted like it hadn't been said. So I did what I did. I went to work. I went to counseling. I vented for 55 minutes. But I continued to do what I had to do in order to survive. Finally, in May of 1985, I had been holding on like I'd been holding on to the edge of a building. And since October, I had felt myself falling. I felt myself falling, and I was powerless to keep myself from falling. Finally, in May 16, 1985, I just let go, and I attempted suicide. And for the attempt, they placed me in a mental hospital. Now, I got to tell you, I'm a borderline genius. My brother told me so, but that was ignorant. Because it's against the law to try and kill yourself. I had wanted to die since I was 7 years old, since 1958, when my grandmother died. Anytime anything came up, I just went to that place in my mind, well, I'll fix you, I'll just die. And the only time I ever attempted to kill myself, my creator said no. And I was very upset. But let me tell you something. They said something about alcoholism, substance abuse, But they also said something about psychotic disorders in that mental hospital. So that's what I focused on. Let's be crazy rather than alcoholic. Also, I still had another angle to shoot. I don't know about you, but, you know, I have accoutrements. I got big brown eyes, you know, butter. And in that mental hospital, there was a tall, dark, long drink of water, and I found myself very thirsty. And the name of the game is You Love Me. This was the psych check. You love me. What I'm sharing is that desperate people do desperate things, and I was a desperate woman alcoholic. I gave him all my disability checks, and 8 days out of the mental institution, before I even understood what the term relapse meant, I relapsed with that psych check in a motel room in Richmond, California. I had a problem. I told him I might have a problem with this tomorrow. When the morning came, he told me I was boring. I went back home, and I'm sitting on a couch in a big house overlooking the San Jose Country Club. And one of those ads comes on TV. It's the kind of ad that if you got the remote control and you're fast enough, you can get past it. The ad said, "Do you have a problem with alcohol and drugs? If so, call this number." I couldn't get past it. The number stuck in my head. I got up, went to the kitchen, got the phone, opened the door, started sneaking down the stairs. Don't know why I was sneaking. Called up the number and got the happiest, happiest woman on the other end of the phone. Her name was Jody. Got all my business out of me. I don't know about you, but Mama used to say, don't put your business in the street. She got all my business. And she referred me to a hospital in Campbell, California, O'Connor Hospital. And I agreed to go because I knew how counseling worked. So I agreed to go the next day at 1 o'clock. And I went in. And what I can tell you is that the archway over the door said, through these doors pass the world's most beautiful people. Through these doors pass the world's most beautiful people. And I went in, still trying to shoot that angle. Well, let me introduce you to my shrink from Belmont Hills. The program director looked at me and said, "Cece, are you willing to go to any length now, Cece?" And I hung my head and I started to cry because I was whipped. I had been beaten into a state of reasonableness. Alcohol and drugs for me beat me into a state of reasonableness. So I told him that I was willing to go to any length. And so they kept me there. What I can share with you is the next morning, I forgot how willing I said I was going to be. Because I woke up, I was hot, I was cold. They had put me in the room with a heroin addict who didn't follow the rules, did not like that. She slept all day, and at night she was knitting, and the sound of the knitting needles going clink, clink, clink got on my last nerve. I tried really hard. I got up. I went up to the nurse's station, and in my nicest, whitest voice, "If you don't mind, I'd like another room. I'm having a little problem sleeping." And the nurse looked at me and said, "Cece, we encourage the patients to work these things out amongst themselves." Okay. Not a problem. I'll take care of it. Went running down the hall, walking over furniture, cussing everybody out of their name. Let me tell you, they got me another room. What I want you to understand is that was the first time that I was ever congruent. It's the first time that what I said and what I did, how I felt, matched. All my life, I had been looking at you, figuring out what it was you wanted to hear, and then delivering the goods. That was the first time that I had been congruent, honest with myself. Something happened in that hospital. They brought in on a Tuesday night at 8 p.m., they brought in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Winchester Mystery Group came into O'Connor at Campbell. And let me tell you, they came into my living room, because now I'm sitting there, arms folded, in sweats, then gained 30 pounds, looked like two pigs in a gunny sack fighting to get out. And I'm looking at these people like, you got to tell me something, because I don't like the way I feel. And these are some happy people. Y'all know how y'all are. Okay, bright eyes, diamond sparkling, patting each other, saying those trite phrases, think, easy does it, first things first. I'm looking like, But something happened in that meeting. There was a pregnant pause. Something propelled me up out of my seat. And I said, I need to hear the stories. I just found out something about myself, and I need to hear the stories. That was my point of identification in Alcoholics Anonymous. At the end of that meeting, a woman with bright red hair and big blue eyes came up to me and put one of those 24-hour desire chippy things in my hand, closed my fingers over it, and said, keep coming back. And I knew that she knew how I felt. She became my sponsor and started me in on the journey of the 12 steps. What I'm here to report is that sobriety is its own reward. Sobriety is its own reward. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who want it, not necessarily for people who need it. And what I know today is you got to want to be sober more than you want to be drunk. So I started in on the journey of the 12 steps as if my life depended on it. But still being slick and a borderline genius, I thought that I could get it really quickly, like about 4 months. That was my cutoff point. I can get this in 4 months. Step one, the hardest step, because I had to concede to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic just like my father. I believe that for every one of us that gets here, there's somebody who has paid the price. It took me until I had 7 years of sobriety before I could acknowledge that he paid the price for me to get here. That's what I know to be a fact. Step two, not a problem. Had walking papers from the mental institution. But step three, don't talk to me about God. I don't want to hear about it. I was raised in the Bible Belt. I can drop and give you 20 minutes of solid prayer without even taking a breath. So no thank you. Let me tell you something. God called me at 7. And I thought, can't you get somebody else? I don't see any other little kids going through stuff like this. Can't you get somebody else? And I'm here to tell you, if God called you and God wants you, God wins. That's my experience. So I did it. And I like to share that, you know, you don't have to do it graciously. See, in that mental hospital where I was put because I tried to kill myself, I got to find somebody who successfully killed herself in the mental hospital on Memorial Day weekend in 1985. I got to find the body. I got to stay a little bit longer. But I called God out right then. I said, you won't let me die, and I don't know how to live, so you had better do something. You had better do something. And what I know is that God heard me, because when I woke up, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that we come to, and we come to believe. I woke up and I was here. On the inventory process in step four, my sponsor was very smart. She said, Cece, tell me what they did to you. If you don't know where to start, start with your mama and your daddy. And tell me what they did to you, Cece. So I started writing it down, what they did to me. You know, they committed adultery. I didn't have to be born. I didn't have to be here. You know what? I started writing it all down. Took it to my sponsor. Started sharing. Didn't see my part on having been born. See, I thought I was a mistake. I heard all women are entitled to one mistake. My sponsor had to share with me, you know what? God didn't make any mistake when you were born. See, my part in that was my mother and father, that was their business. Their love affair. I'm a love child. I didn't know that. That was their business. I had to let go of the resentment. I had to have more information. See, if you're a know-it-all like me and somebody gives you a piece of information that you've never even considered, the lights come on. The lights came on. So I gave it all up to my sponsor. And then 6 and 7, oh, Lord, I could tell you she was overbearing. She was this, she was that. And my sponsor pointed out that while I'm pointing a finger out here, look at how many are pointing back at me. She introduced me to those three fingers pointing back at me. She introduced me to the dictionary to look up some of these defects of character. And what I found out is they had a spiritual commonality that exercising all of those defects of character cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And the truth of the matter is I'm a farm girl from Kansas. I know how to cook. I can cook better for 200 than I can for 2. It's like I never had an opportunity to be me until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and started uncovering and discovering who I am. I'm looking out here and I'm looking into a mirror. And I see a lot of me sitting in front of me. I made the list, and of course grandiosity was one of my defects of character. That's why you make that 8-step list with the sponsor, because she cut it down to size. She goes, you wasn't this bad. Okay? She cut it down to a manageable size. And I'm sitting in a meeting one Saturday afternoon, the gratitude group, 1:30 meeting, hour and a half meeting, and I'm whining and puling, me and my life, and I look up and I look into the face of an old timer, and they have that kind of look like, steps would help. And I got it. See, I was sitting on my 9th step. And I said, it's easier for me to sit up here and whine and puke than to finish my 9th step. So I shut up, I sat down, but I finished my 9th step. And what happened when I finished my 9th step is that my eyes came up off the floor. I had been taught that the eyes are the windows of the soul. All my life I had been looking down because I didn't want you to see that hatred. When I finished my 9th step, my eyes came up off the floor, and I could look anybody straight in the eye. It was a level playing field. I was equal. It's amazing. That's why they say the promises come true after step 9. Something happened. With step 10, I cannot tell a lie. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I can admit when you wrong, real promptly. I'm just going to claim progress on my side. Step 11 is the crux of the program that I work. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. You know what? I made peace with the God of my understanding. I made peace. It's like, you want me? Okay, but you're going to have to do everything, and you're going to have to be everything to me. And I surrendered. And I'm here. I'm here because of the 12th step. I'm here to pass on what was so freely given to me. I was told I cannot keep it unless I'm willing to give it away. And so that is why I'm here instead of home watching The Voice. Because this is my life. Since July 8, 1985, this is what sustains me. As a result of sobriety, I went back to school. I went to school for 14 years. Got degrees all up the wazoo. You know, that call that came at 7, I finally said yes. You know, so I ended up getting a bachelor's degree in English from Santa Clara, and then a master's in spirituality and pastoral ministries. And I came here in 2004 to enter seminary at the Candler School of Theology. So when the bottom fell out of the economy in 2008, I came away from school, 21 units away from my second master's. I became an ordained minister. Hope I didn't cuss up here. Became an ordained minister. Started my own retreat business. You know what? Redoing my house to do spiritual direction. My whole life has changed as a result of you loving me. So they used to say, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. And I thought, oh, bunch of hooey. But you know what? I say the same thing today. Let me see a show of hands of people in your first 5 years of sobriety. Do me a favor. Don't kill yourself before your 5th birthday. If you do, you will be killing a total stranger. You have no idea. You have no idea. I am not the same person who was brought in here. I can tell you this right now, that I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous, because Alcoholics Anonymous loved me first when I was hostile and warlike. And I came in here hostile and warlike and shooting from the hip. Just give me a reason. If I have a hot flash, that's a reason. That's why I carry a fan now. I'm going to end with this, because I found this in the second institution, in the second hospital, when they were having an emergency meeting for Cece's anger. I saw a chapel, and I went into it, and I found this, and it was the last prayer there, and so I took it. This is the original right here. Okay, so I have carried this with me, and I end with this a lot. It's a take on the 11-step prayer. It says, Lord God, make me an instrument of your healing. When I am weak and in pain, help me to rest. When I am anxious, help me to wait. When I am fearful, help me to trust. When I am lonely, help me to love. When I place you apart from me, help me to know you are near. Healing God, Grant me not so much to demand everything from myself as to let others help me, nor to expect others to cure me as to do my own part toward getting better. Grant me not so much to seek escape as to face myself and learn the depths of your love. For it is in being uncertain and not in control that we find true faith. In knowing the limits of mind and body that we find wholeness of spirit. And in passing through death that we find life that lasts forever. If it had been up to me, I would have offed me. But it wasn't. God said no. And then God sent me to you. And when I look out here, I see God with skin on. You are God with skin on. If this is your first time, welcome to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are returning after a relapse, welcome to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. And if you want this thing, we will go to the wall with you. But you got to want it. You have got to want it. It has been a privilege and an honor to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for that. I needed that. I want a copy of that prayer too, please. Get the Xerox machine, somebody.
Try.